Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us today. Dennis is traveling today and couldn't be here with us, so I'm going to, try and kick off the call. And actually, I'd like to begin by applauding the efforts of all of our members in this concerted readiness activities. I mean, it's really evident the hard work that everybody's doing, and is very much appreciated. I view your actions as a testament to the critical role you play and serve in protecting your communities. We very much also appreciate the exceptional efforts by the Department of Health in providing guidance, support, and assistance, and they're joining us today. But I just want to mention in preliminary comments that yesterday afternoon I was on a national call sponsored by the American Hospital Association, which included several federal agency representatives. And during the course of that discussion, it really became very clear to me anyway that New York State is pretty far ahead of much of the rest of the nation in its preparedness efforts. And you are all to be congratulated for making New York State such a leader. Thank you again for that. As a leader, you're a pioneer, too, though, so issues are coming up here before they're coming up in other areas of the country and need to be addressed more rapidly here. Today, I'm pleased to welcome our speakers again, Dr. Gus Burkhead, lead in the Office of Public Health in the Department of Health, and joining Gus is Mr. Ernest Clement, also from the Office of Public Health, and we also have back with us today Mr. Dan Shepherd, who's represents the Office of Health Systems Management in the Department of Health. And I have to say that both these folks have been extremely helpful as we work through this, and we're very much appreciative of their their continued assistance and support. After some brief opening remarks, I believe, from Gus, then we'll just really open it up to questions. I realized last time that there were more questions than we had time to get to. That call was recorded as today's will be as well, and we'll share that information with our members so you can access the calls. And happy to have Gus and Dan with us again today, so to respond to your continuing needs. I know as we dig down deeper into the weeds in implementing these activities, different issues arise, and we very much appreciate the efforts of the department in trying to help us respond to each of these. And today's your opportunity to seek their guidance and assistance and follow up the last week. I think with that, I'll now turn the discussion over to Gus, and then we can proceed from there, if that's okay with you, Gus.
Great. Thanks very much, Fred, and thanks, everybody, for getting on the call this afternoon. I thought I would just start off with a couple of updates and also address a couple questions that Fred forwarded on to us after the last call and try to get some of those out of the way. So there have been a couple of new guidance documents coming out from CDC. One that I wanted to highlight particularly for your attention is an ambulatory care guidance, which came out a few days ago. You can get these documents from the CDC main Ebola webpage. But this ambulatory care guidance, I think, would apply in all of your ambulatory care settings in the hospital. And it speaks about how to, of course, ask questions about travel and symptoms to try and identify any patient who might be potentially a person under investigation for Ebola. It also speaks about and basically in an ambulatory care setting, your main goal is, assuming the patient is not acutely ill and needing stabilization, is to get that patient transferred to the appropriate level of care. It does also speak about the personal protective equipment or PPE is needed in that type of setting, and it's not, of course, the full-blown type of PPE that you would use if you were treating a patient in the hospital ongoing. So in the ambulatory care setting, it's really limited to face shield, surgical mask, gown, impermeable gown, and two pairs of gloves if you should get a person who meets the criteria. I will say that we are hearing about a lot of quote-unquote suspect Ebola cases. Most of them lack the travel history within 21 days, and so I think that's important. We get a lot of calls of people traveling elsewhere in Africa. At this point, that's not a risk. We also get a lot of calls people who were think they were in touch with someone who may have been in Africa, and of course those are also not a concern at this point. That ambulatory care document, it's a pretty simple one-page flow chart. I think would be helpful for you in thinking through what you need to be doing in other than the emergency department, but in your ambulatory care settings. There was a question last time about the fever cutoff, and in various CDC documents you see different fever levels mentioned. I think at this point the CDC is using, for the person under investigation definition, basically any subjective fever. This ambulatory care document says any subjective fever or greater than 100.4 or 38 degrees Celsius. Even a lower grade fever, I think in someone with the travel history and with potentially these other Ebola compatible symptoms, even a lower grade fever should be a cause for concern and to take, you know, the cautious step and isolate the patient and call the health department. There were also, so that I suggest you take a look at that one. There is an announcement today by CDC that they are purchasing $2.7 million worth of personal protective equipment to go into the strategic national stockpile, and the purpose of that PPE is to have it available should an Ebola case occur in a hospital, and CDC then, I think, intends to distribute that. They are preparing this into 50 sort of go kits, as they call them, so they will be able to supply a hospital that has a documented Ebola case pretty quickly with supplies. We at the state health department also have a stockpile, small stockpile, that is available for the treatment of an Ebola patient if that should occur. So that's just a news story from CDC today that's coming out. We understand that CDC is working on a lot of additional guidance in a number of different areas. One of those areas is in the area of pregnancy and maternity care with patients with Ebola. This would probably only be a consideration in a designated hospital where Ebola patients are being cared for, but there have been a lot of questions about maternity care, so there's a guidance coming on that. I think there's also a reworked guidance around EMS issues with Ebola that CDC is going to be putting out, and we understand both of these that I just mentioned are coming out within the next couple of days. There were a couple other questions that came up at the last call that I thought I would just touch on to just get them out of the way, I guess. The one question related to sort of the ethical issues around treatment of Ebola patients, whether you do CPR, what kinds of clinical procedures would you do if the patient needed a cardiac cath or a MI or something with Ebola. And I think that's an area that we have been hearing questions about. We have a unit of the state health department called the Task Force on Life and the Law, which is made up of a group of prominent ethicists and clinicians. And so we're actually working on some guidance around those kinds of issues that might arise when you have an Ebola patient. So I won't say more about that now, but only to say that we are working on that topic. There was also a question about the whole process of transferring a person under investigation or a confirmed patient to a designated center and how, you know, sort of how that should work. I think in the commissioner's order, we asked each hospital to develop a plan about how they would either transfer out a patient to a treatment center, or if you're one of the treatment centers, how you would receive those patients. And I think we can't envision every scenario of where someone might show up and where they might need to go. So I think we do want you to have discussion with your primary EMS or ambulance service provider and with the hospitals in the region that have been either are your tertiary hospitals or have been designated as Ebola treatment hospitals about how that transfer would work. I think probably from some of the smaller community hospitals and rural hospitals, it might make sense if the patient is stable to have the ambulance service that's coming from the designated center to come out and get the patient and take them back, rather than have one of the small rural ambulance EMS companies do that. But that's sort of the I think we need to ask you to sort of have those discussions and figure out what makes the most sense. Of course, if you get a suspect patient that meets the criteria and there's concern, call your local health department. The state health department will get involved very quickly in discussions and a decision made at what's the appropriate time to move that patient. If the patient is stable, I think we would obviously prefer to move sooner rather than later. So those would be sort of on a case-by-case basis. I think the one last thing that I'll two more things. One is the question has come up, what if you're unable to get PPE? I'm not sure where CDC is ordering their $2.7 million in PPE from, but that will probably add additional strain to the supply delays that people have been experiencing. So just in terms of the commissioner's order, I think we understand that it's difficult to order these supplies right now. We did send out CDC's revised PPE guidance about 10 days ago and extended the deadline of the order, but really at this point we're not using the order as an enforcement tool. We're really using it as a technical assistance and guidance tool for you all. So continue to try and order the PPE that you think you need and is appropriate for your setting. But if you can show good faith in trying to get that, we're not going to ding you on a survey at this point. And the final question related to some difficulties in getting lab tests at some community hospitals where, for example, a contractor is running the lab and have some of the large national contract lab chains have said they won't conduct routine tests on patients with suspect Ebola. So we're aware of that issue. We're working with the main lab companies, LabCorp and Quest are two that come to mind, about this issue. I don't think it probably doesn't make sense for every hospital to buy point of care testing equipment, particularly smaller hospitals, for use in the rare instance where somebody might show up with a history compatible with Ebola. So I think we'd like to try and work. We have guidance on our website about how to safely do sort of critical tests, a CBC, electrolytes, other things that you would need to evaluate a patient. And again, most of these quote-unquote suspect cases turn out not to meet even the basic criteria. So I think we'd have to be careful throwing around even the term that we have a suspect Ebola case, because that gets everybody concerned when if they don't have the specific travel history within 21 days and the specific symptom complex, it's not really a suspect case at all. So there shouldn't be any limitation. So we are aware of the potential that, lab folks will be concerned about doing testing on suspect cases and are trying to work with that. So that covers a number of the questions I think that Fred Heigl had sent after the last call. And I think, Fred, if it's okay, we can go ahead and open up for questions at this point.
Yes, thank you, Gus. That's very helpful information, and we appreciate it. And, operator, if we could open up for questions, we'd appreciate that also. Thank you.
Thank you. If you would like to ask a question or have a comment, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. This will place your question in the order it was received. Once again, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad now. Once again, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. That will place you in the question queue. And we'll go ahead and take our first question.
Hi, this is Don Chen from Westchester Medical Center. The question is in regards to the isolation room and ambulatory care sites. Is it required that room has a commode or toilet and sink?
I think the order does say that you need a commode, yeah. And I think there needs to be a sink in the area so that the staff can do proper hand washing when they've doffed the PPE. But yeah, I think if some arrangement so that the patient doesn't have to go wandering around the hospital to use the bathroom, I think is the point there.
Does the sink have to be in the room, though? I mean, I understand the principle, but sometimes we can't get the sink in the room or the toilet exactly in the room.
I don't think the sink needs to be in the room. Sorry, Dan Shepard, my comment.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think, and I think we're just distinguishing. I mean, you mentioned you're calling from Westchester, so you're. I think we have to distinguish between community hospitals and tertiary centers and I think that we're talking about in terms of the readiness of a non-tertiary center really has to do with the ability to isolate for a short period of time. I think a commode is required. I think depending on, again, because the layout of each facility is different, the location of the sink is something that when the teams do the readiness assessment visits, most of which have been completed, they'll identify as an issue if it seems like it's not close enough proximity.
I think the order really refers to a sink, hand washing being available for the staff, particularly when they're taking off the PPE, so that it doesn't need to be in the room.
Right. Yeah, so we're referring specifically to ambulatory sites, all these clinics that are probably very low risk for people presenting there. And also, would Purell be acceptable then for hand washing?
Well, I think Purell does. The information we have is that, alcohol-based hand wipes do. This is an envelope virus, so it's very sensitive. So if there's no visible material on the hands, which would require hand washing, you can do that. But I think hand washing is, if available, is probably preferable. So if you've got that in the vicinity, that would be good.
And then the same requirement for ambulatory as for the tertiary inpatient hospital?
I'd have to go back and look at the specifics of the order, but I think in any setting where you're going to isolate a patient and you're going to have staff donning PPE, it's good to have hand washing available. When you get into an inpatient setting, then I think there need to be a lot more attention to having real hand washing there. But I think any hospital that's going to be setting up a unit to care for an Ebola patient would have that as a primary consideration.
Thank you.
Great.
Next question. Hi. This is Dr. Deutsch from Center Life Healthcare. We have 11 PACE centers that have DTCs, but also with those DTCs are DHCs, day health centers. We are complying with doing screening, but are asking the Department of Health to consider wavering us from having to train over 100 employees with protective equipment and do some of the things that we feel hospitals are obligated to do. We do not get patients in those DTCs off of the street. These are chronically ill people who only get chronic care. We've submitted this, but we haven't really heard anything back from the Department of Health. Can you comment on this?
Sure. This is Dan Shepard. So thank you very much. And we've heard this from several providers, and dialysis as well as PACE MLTCP clinics that exist for those populations. As written, the order is not sensitive to different types of Article 28 clinics. I think we recognize that as Dr. Burke had said earlier, right at this point, the order is not, we're not using it as an enforcement tool. I think we are trying to come up with a way of reasonably applying that order to Article 28 providers who, because of unique circumstances and very specific patient populations, are going to be very, very low risk. We're not there yet, trying to figure out where to strike the line, so it makes sense. But we're working on it. We certainly recognize the issue.
And this is Gus Burkett. I think also it's necessary to train hundreds of staff. I think if you could have a few designated staff who you would train, who would, in the event that this happened, would be able. I mean, you really only need one person in the room probably. So a couple people on every shift would be probably adequate.
Yeah, it's always risky in these to generalize, but again, given that the layout of each facility is different with the patient populations are different, but I think in the case of DNTCs that sound probably like of the layout, like one that would serve a PACE population, if someone in the unlikely instance someone were to show up with answers to questions that would make them a suspect Ebola patient, the premium there would be, and this should be included in any policies or procedures you have to isolate them in whatever the most convenient and appropriate room with a door is, and call 911. I think the need to train as the majority of your staff to deal with this is probably unlikely. But again, we're trying to work. We understand the issue. We're trying to develop a rational implementation of the order to address it.
Thank you.
We'll go on to our next question.
Hi, this is Bobby from the Western New York Healthcare Alliance. Is there any provisions or any planning in place for patients that are mildly symptomatic that have the pertinent travel history that need to have the Ebola test done, the lab test done? Is there any provisions to have that testing done in the home rather than transporting to the local hospital? And then once the lab results come back, if it was a positive test, then they could go to the designated Ebola center. Is there anything or any way that them patients can be tested at home and transported to the local hospital?
Well, at this point, the only testing that's available is through the state lab in Albany or the city health department lab in New York City. So if you're in Western New York, that would involve, and we do have a transport that the health department will provide to get the sample in, but you're talking about a four-hour ride minimum from when the sample is collected and a six-hour turnaround on the test, and you've got to get somebody into the home to draw the blood. So I think probably we have not talked about trying to do this at someone's home. I think we want to try to get them into some kind of controlled medical setting to do that, particularly if they're becoming ill.
Thank you.
Yep.
We'll go on to our next question. Hi, I have a question regarding PPE training. I know initially we had to go through and do hands-on training with all of our staff that might be in contact with an Ebola patient. Now, when the state was here, they recommended and said that we needed to do monthly training. Do we have to do hands-on monthly training, or can we have them review a video and provide training PPE for them?
That's a good question. I think the order does talk about doing practicing of donning and doffing. I don't know, Ernie Clement, if you're on, if you have any more detail on that. I think if you use PPE for practice, you can save that PPE and use it again the next time, so you're not burning through a lot of PPE.
And that's what we are doing. We're reusing the PPE exclusively for training. But I was just wondering, as of now, we're physically going around with the trainers to our employees.
Yeah.
Is it a monthly thing that we have to do?
I think that's the way the order is laid out, and it's to get people, comfortable with the physical, putting on and taking off. So again, I think you can limit it to the team that would be actually, providing care. It doesn't have to be every employee in the hospital and that kind of thing. So you know, we'll see, you know, where this Ebola outbreak goes. It may be that that can be relaxed, but I think the big message that we took from the Texas situation was that the, you know, meticulous attention to the PPE is important. So that's, I think, why, and that doing it with a buddy and practicing it is important. So that's why it was put in there.
And it's a skill that tends to get failed. So with some regular interval, having the workforce practice.
Okay. Right. Thank you very much.
Sure thing. Thanks.
We'll go on to our next question.
Hello, this is Judy Lindbergh from St. Anthony Community Hospital. Are hospitals required to have a transfer agreement with an Ebola-designated center, and if so, who should we contact?
I don't think that we require a written agreement, but I think we advise that you have a conversation with either the nearest designated center or a tertiary center, if there's not one in your area, about this. Dan?
Yeah, I interpret written agreement as a legal contract of sorts. I think it's important that you be able to demonstrate that you have a relationship and have had, you know, a plan, a transfer plan to a designated center. I wouldn't put the bar as high as a written agreement. I think it just needs to be in your plan, and a logical question to ask if a designated center is in your plan is that does that center know that they're in your plan?
Thank you.
On to our next question.
Hi there. Bernadette Cassells from Community Memorial Hospital in Hamilton, New York. We're a tiny, small hospital, and I have a question that goes along with the PPE. We have about 20 people who work a shift, every shift, so we have to keep doing rotating PPE for all of our employees, which is depleting our supplies of PPE. Do you know anything about the stockpiles that are being pulled up there, and should we be concerned about going through all of the stockpile that we have, or should we just use through it because we need to, because commissioner's order says to?
Well, I think one suggestion is to try and save the PPE from one training session to the next. So if you can take it off without ripping it or destroying it, you can use it again. You don't have to open new PPE each time.
And the hard thing with that is that the people that are putting it on are getting so hot and they're sweating that we can't reuse it. People are, like, physically being overcome with heat and discomfort. And so the other issue that we're having is, when it comes time to taking care of an Ebola patient, it's not going to be somebody who's going to be able to be in the room for.
Right. So I guess a question is what you're training with. So the basic PPE that I mentioned in this ambulatory care document is the impermeable gown, face shield, surgical mask, and gloves. So we're not talking, you know, in a small community hospital, I don't think you need to have Tyvek suits or anything of that sort. If it's an issue, people are overheating, you could save their kit and have them use it again the next time. I think the reason for doing this is to, because the information that, you know, practicing this with a buddy is the best way to really cement it, assuming this Ebola outbreak doesn't go on forever, we probably won't be doing this forever, hopefully. I think we would all appreciate a break from it. But at this point, I think we're sort of on high alert and want to be sure that folks are ready. So that's the rationale.
But this is Dan Shepard. If I could just ask a question, what are you training? What is your staff training in? Is it full suits or fluid-proof gowns, masks, and a face shield?
We are using the fluid-proof gowns, and we haven't been able to find any fluid-proof gowns that they aren't really completely fluid-proof, because what happens is if you get sprayed with something, it will go right through the seams where the suture line is on the seams, things are going through, so we're double gowning and we're using the N95 mask to get them used to putting on and taking off the N95, especially because the way you take off an N95 with Ebola is completely different than you do with a TB patient, because we always were taught that you grasp the front of the mask and keep it secured to your face, and they're saying absolutely not to do that, to not touch your face at all. So we want people to actually learn how to do that maneuver.
Okay, so just the N95 is really not required for the sort of initial evaluation in a small hospital before transfer out. That's N95 would be used in a center caring for a patient long term. So I think you can get away with surgical masks in your training. You don't have to use up N95s. That may make people a little more comfortable too, because an N95 can be difficult to breathe through. I think those are the suggestions. Try to reuse. If you're having trouble, identifying products, our staff can probably help you if you want to put in a request on the help email. We could try to help advise you on that. But I think a single gown, the appropriate fluid resistant type, gloves, mask, face shield are all that's needed.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks. Next question.
John Kasten from Unity Hospital in Rochester. Regarding the submitting questions to the FAQs, what kind of turnaround time can we expect? We submitted 3 questions early last week, and we've had no response and nothing on the FAQ page.
No, I apologize. We've got folks working on it. I think we probably have a backlog there, but we'll try to get them up as quickly as we can. I think it's probably about a week to get questions up there with the clearance that we do. But we'll work on it. You're right. We have been backed up on them.
And we'll go on to our next question.
Hi, I initially had one question, but now we have 2 because it seems like we're getting some mixed messages here. It sounds like you're saying that we would use level 1 PPE, being a gown, 2 gloves, a surgical mask, and shield for triage, and then we're transferring the patient out. However, in our organization, we expect to have a patient here for several hours before they could be transferred out. So we've been training level 1 for the initial triage and then going to level 2 PPE for any kind of close contact and personal care. Is that not true?
Ernie, are you on the phone? Can you help with that question?
Yeah, yes, I'm here. You have to take into consideration the presentation of the patient as well. It's not an automatic thing that once the person goes into your isolation and evaluation room that you have to automatically step up the PPE. If the person is, febrile and having body aches, what we sort of call dry symptoms, it's certainly not necessary to move up your PPE. On the other hand, if the person's vomiting and they have diarrhea, then, yes, you would have to move to a level of protection that would protect the workers from contact with the body fluids.
Okay, so, that makes sense. Okay, my other question is, we need to know if freestanding urgent care that is in an outpatient-only setting but it's operated by a hospital, does that fall under the ambulatory care guidance?
I would say so, yeah, yes.
Okay, thank you.
We'll go on to our next question.
Bless you. Hi, thank you. So my question is regarding the reassessment. In the order, it indicates that reassess the covered personnel every month after they initially achieve satisfactory competence. Are we looking at a 30-day requirement, or if they were trained in October, in mid-October, can we do it at sometime in the month of November? It's an interpretation question of monthly reassessment.
Yeah, I think we're not going to count days. So if you can demonstrate you've got some kind of a training schedule that hits people every month, that'd be fine.
Okay. And I just also wanted to comment on the requirement relative to the use of PPE. We are reusing PPE, but you really can't reuse those N95 respirators, which we are training with. We think it's important for the staff to practice the N95 respirators. They are different in removing than a regular surgical mask, and they need to practice that. And the gloves as well, you can't really reuse.
Right, can't reuse the gloves, that's right.
So,
I mean, it's great that you're doing the training on the N95. It's not required for the sort of the basic, PPE that you would need to evaluate a patient. The N95 isn't required for.
We're not a designated center either.
Yep.
However, since it will take time for that blood test, so our transferring facility. In our county, will not transfer that patient until they are confirmed positive. So based on the fact that the testing would either go to New York City or to the lab up in Albany, we're assuming we're going to have these patients for a significant number of time, a significant amount of time, hours.
Right. I think it gets back to the previous comment, though. The N95 is really recommended when you have a patient who's, on a respirator, you're going to be doing some kind of an invasive procedure that might generate aerosol. I think that at the stage you're talking about, these are the quote-unquote dry patients without a lot of aerosolization of material, and so the N95 is not really recommended or needed at that stage. The N95 you would use when you are caring for a patient in an inpatient setting over a long period of time, and you're having issues with, diarrhea and needing to be on a ventilator and other things, that's when the N95 is needed.
I think we should just go with the
okay.
N95.
Thank you.
We're
going to.
Yep.
We'll go on to our next question.
Hi, this is Dan Shepard from Stony Brook University Hospital. If we begin to do some lab tests on a suspected Ebola patient, but then we found out that the patient, in fact, was negative for Ebola, how would the PPE and the waste be removed? Would that still be considered regulated medical waste?
If the Ebola test is negative, it's not an Ebola patient. I think you treat it just as your normal. You would normally treat PPE in your institution.
Okay.
I don't know the. Yeah, I don't. Go ahead. Next question.
There are no other questions in the queue at the moment.
This is Fred at Haney's. Folks, this is your opportunity to ask questions. If there are no more and the topics have been covered that you're interested in, I don't want to hold Gus and Dan and Ernie any longer than necessary either. So if you've got something on your mind, now's your opportunity to please ask it. And we do very much appreciate, all the efforts of the folks at the Department of Health in assisting us with this. Thanks.
And once again, if you would like to ask a question, it's *1 on your telephone keypad. And we do have one more question that came in, so we'll go ahead and take it.
Hi, I have a question regarding the disinfection of PPE when a person exits the room having provided care. One of our physicians would like to be sprayed down with a disinfectant. Do you have any recommendations regarding that?
Ernie, you may want to comment on this as well, but I think in the U.S., CDC is recommending not using disinfectant spray because it creates, wet material on the floor. It's messy and may not be necessary. I don't know. Ernie, do you have any other comment on that?
Oh, I agree. The CDC has specific steps in their document for doffing PPE when caring for an inpatient, and it's very, very detailed, and the spraying is not necessary in the U.S.
Thank you.
And we'll go on to our next question.
Hi. Is there any more information about the potential White House Ebola funding request and the details of that and when that might happen?
I think we don't know any more than you do reading the paper, but there has been a specific request with a breakout that includes, you know, resources for hospitals and public health. So I think my understanding is Congress would not come back until early December to actually potentially vote on it. So that's sort of the time frame, I think. Dan, do you have other?
No, I would just rest assured that the state and the healthcare associations, Haney's, Greater New York, are all, you know, focused. The appropriate people in those organizations are focused on this. Are making efforts to identify both costs that have been incurred as well as projected costs, the need for maintaining appropriate stockpiles of PPE, all those things. And so there are folks working on this, including your own association that's sponsoring this call. And again, just based on in a sense, a pretty high-level announcement yesterday.
Right.
We don't have a lot of information other than a willingness.
Right.
The good news is a willingness on the part of the federal government, or at least the White House, and hopefully Congress, to recognize the costs of preparing and responding to Ebola.
But, you know, by all means, your organization should make your needs known.
Yep.
Yeah, this is Fred, and we certainly are. In fact, we obviously are aware of the announcement, but a lot of details are as yet uncertain or undefined, and we're trying to work that through the various channels that we use to ensure that New York State gets its fair share anyway. But as Gus described or Dan mentioned, that it's going to depend on Congress, and likelihood of anything happening before December is probably uncertain, unclear. Clear and unlikely, probably, because it's going to depend on how Congress asks us when it comes back. But we are certainly pressing for New York State to get its fair share of any federal funds that become available. I can assure you that. Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll go on to our next question.
Hi, good afternoon. This is Pat Richards from Cobolsko Regional, a small rural facility. I have a question about the designated facilities. I did try to reach out to the closest, which would be Syracuse for us, but I wanted to know, are there designated points of contact for each designated facility for us to reach out to?
That's a good question. I don't know that we have identified that, Nate. That's probably something that we ought to do. We'll take that suggestion back and talk with the centers about it. It's a good idea.
Thank you.
We'll go on to our next question.
I had a question also about the crematories, not being able to cremate people after you've sprayed them down and wiped the body bags down with bleach. Do you have any more information on that?
I believe we've recently heard that the body bags which contain chlorine there's a environmental rule against cremating them, so we're working on getting body bags that don't include chlorine. I think if you wipe them down and wash them down, you can, whatever you wash them down with, you can eventually wash off with water. So I think once we have the appropriate container, the bags, I think it shouldn't be a problem.
Okay, because the recommendations that we've read is that you spray the patient down and then you wipe down the outside of the body bag with chlorine bleach. So there's going to be like a good amount of chlorine on top of the body and inside the body bag just from what we're doing to disinfect the body and the bag.
Well, yeah, but I think at the end you can then wash off with just water to remove, you know, the chlorine that's there. I don't think that'll be an issue. We can check on it, though.
Thank you.
And we'll go on to our next caller.
This is Jane Cooley from the Western New York Healthcare Association. Some of our hospitals are asking if they have to redo their vouchering contract since the deliverables have changed to mostly Ebola-related things. Should they call grants administration, or will they be getting information about that?
So this is specifically to the hospital preparedness grant from the state health department?
Correct.
I think we'll get communication out to you about that.
Thank you.
And that was the last question in the queue.
Well, I think that that you guys at the Department of Health have been very helpful, and everybody could use an extra few minutes today. So I think I'd like to thank all the participants on today's call, as well as in particular Gus, Jan, and Ernie at the Department of Health. And if there's a need, we may call upon you folks again, and obviously we can do so in writing as we go along. I know issues will arise as people get further and further into this preparation. We appreciate everybody's effort in preparation. We appreciate the support of the Department of Health. And I think at this point I'd like to thank everybody for being on today's call and hopefully give everybody a little 10 minutes more time in their day and wrap things up right now. Thank you.